Now, if you turn back to the conference booklet, page 11, I just want to make one last point about when we're looking at the successes of Henry's rule to the mid-1250s, and these are diplomatic successes. Henry's wife, Eleanor of Provence, was the sister-in-law of the King of France. And after 1243, she managed to persuade Henry into a better relationship with Louis IX of France. And after all, an unbroken truce with France was going to be the key to Henry's survival in these years. But additionally, Henry was very lucky with regard to Wales and Scotland. There were minorities and succession struggles in those areas, which kept them neutralized until at least the mid-1250s. And in addition to this, there are these foreign relations at Henry's courts. In the 1230s, the Queen's Savoyard relations. These were not just useless favourites, as Matthew Paris would have us believe. The Savoyards were one of the greatest families in Europe, with a foot in both the papal and the imperial camps. And they were great diplomats, and they were instrumental in both keeping Henry in good odour with the Pope, but also in steering him into a largely peaceful foreign policy, which, of course, suited Henry. And even the Lusignan favourites that were going to be later so vilified, the Poitevins at Henry's courts, were assets. They were the leading family from Poitou, although they had a wider prestige in their own rights. They had a link with the kings of Jerusalem. And they could be extremely useful, for example, during Henry's largely defensive campaign in Gascony in 1253. They were instrumental in his successes there because they provided at least a quarter of the knights for it from their contacts in Poitou. So surrounded by powerful alliances at home and abroad, it is not so surprising that Henry could, for many years, ride safely through the ups and downs of English domestic policies. However, by the mid-1250s, things were clearly going wrong. In June 1256, Henry commissioned for his bathroom wall at Westminster Palace a painting so starkly different from his usual upbeat pictures of sainted kings and heroes. He commissioned this painting, "The King Rescued by His Dogs from the Sedition Plotted by His Subjects." What was going wrong? What was to bring Henry down by 1258? Well, first of all, there were developments almost under the king's nose. Relation between Henry and his lesser subjects were not so rosy. Minor barons and knights in the provinces viewed Henry very differently from the great magnates at court. Unwarlike Henry did not inspire them. Many were clearly very frustrated by Henry's repeated bans on tournaments. Henry's cosmopolitan court was not universally appreciated. Provincial society had old fears of rule by foreigners. And there was also a lot of pent-up resentment against courtiers and magnates who were allowed to ride roughshod over the rights of lesser people thanks to Henry's indulgence. Henry's harsh local government was also much resented. A nice, if somewhat exceptional, example is Dorset, where I come from nowadays. If you lived down in deepest Dorset in the 1250s, you were groaning under Henry's rule. By 1258, Henry had increased annual financial pressure on the sheriff by 400%. This echoes, I think, of the current government, doesn't it? For the first half of the decade, there'd been a complete foreigner as sheriff, and then he was followed by Englishmen who were not much better. And after 1255, this foreigner, a man called Elias de Rabane, who was a Poitevin, retained hold of the only significant royal castle in Dorset, which is Corfe Castle, and two out of three of Dorset's ports were controlled by foreigners, Lyme by Elias and Weymouth by Aymer, the bishop-elect of Winchester. Now, at the heart of the provincial complaints against Henry were his financial pressure on sheriffs and other officials, which increased their corruption and misgovernment. Finance was an old sore that Henry had never been able to heal. His main problem was that, although it's not strictly true to say that he never received any grants from Parliament, he never managed to manage or bully his parliaments to grant him a major tax after 1237. This created a vicious circle of financial problems which dogged Henry throughout his reign. The costs of government, even in peacetime, were rising. And Henry, of course, also had to defend vulnerable Gascony. So much of his energies during this period were taken in financial drives to raise money without resorting to parliamentary grants. At first, his government was very successful. Hubert de Burgh had managed to transform royal income from a pitiful state in which it had been left by King John. Only £8,000 per annum in 1216, by 1230 being much transformed to £24,000. Ironically, partly through Hubert's deft management of Parliament. By the early 1240s, Henry may have doubled that to about £40,000 per annum. This was his maximum income. And it was only a pale shadow of King John's income, and worth less thanks to inflation. It was just about enough for Henry to rule in style and even to save up a little treasure, but not enough to wage major warfare. But all this was only achieved by a series of short-term policies which stored up future problems. Many sources of Henry's predecessors were now blocked off thanks to Magna Carta, for example, exploitation of feudal dues. Vigorous exploitation, you might think, of the king's crown lands could have been attempted. And indeed, it periodically was, but it's normally abandoned because it stirred up too many vested interests. Instead, it was much easier to turn the screws on sheriffs and local government, or to exploit revenue from profits of justice, or periodically touring judicial and forest heirs, or to extort money from merchants and towns, or to exercise purveyance, which is a nice little dodge, whereby you either don't pay for goods taken from the king's court or you pay at less than the market price. And Henry's best wheeze of all, I'm sorry to say, was merciless taxation of England's Jews. Professor Robert Stacey has discovered that between 1244 and 1250, Henry took £60,000 from Jewish taxation, adding a vital 25% or more slice of revenue, which kept him solvent. Now, the problem was these policies taxed mainly Henry's lesser subjects. The focus for popular discontent was Parliament. Here we see a repeated chorus of complaints against oppressive and corrupt royal officials. There was also rising resentment of the perceived cost and capriciousness of the legal system. Hence the cry in Parliament to restore the Justiciar and Chancellor. These were legal officials thought to be more open to general scrutiny. In fact, beside the 1244 paper constitution, there were demands in 1248 to 9 and in 1255 for properly accountable general and great officials, the Justiciar, Treasurer and Chancellor, to assist the king's rule. Until the king could pose as a reformer, there would be no grants of money from Parliament. And Parliament hardly going to vote Henry any money for war, since he was no good at it. But Henry repeatedly resisted demands for reform. It did his reputation no good to know that his great rival, the King of France, had in the 1240s launched widespread reform of officials before setting off on crusade. Nevertheless, nothing much happened in England before 1258, perhaps because Henry was too weak or vested interests were too strong. One aspect of this was that complaints against oppressive baronial estate officials were just as widespread as complaints against the king's men. And of course, Henry could not risk disciplining the baronage. Perhaps Henry was able to divide opposition for a while by varying the intensity with which she exploited some regions or groups, or the ways in which she sold charters to individuals. But as the 1250s rolled on, one can see a real crisis on the horizon. Henry's financial methods were the law of diminishing returns, and his income had dropped back below £30,000 per annum. The Jewish community was exhausted of money. In 1257, the King's Council began tinkering with a new oath and reforms to embrace even local government. But as ever happened, nothing happened. Henry, it seemed, could not be trusted to reform. Now, opposition was well underway before 1258 because of Henry's sudden abandonment of caution in foreign policy. Henry's always one to surprise one in some ways, because the Sicilian business was made public in 1255. This was a scheme whereby Henry commuted his crusader's vow in favour of waging a crusade in Sicily against the Pope's enemies. The crown of Sicily was to go to Henry's second son, Edmund. This was an unbelievable fantasy, given Henry's military weakness. Nevertheless, he persisted at it and even committed himself to pay the Pope £90,000, potentially creating a serious debt. Why did Henry do this? Well, nobody really knows. It's possible that he thought that Sicily for Edmund might compensate for not being able to recover Normandy. Nevertheless, this Sicilian business met consistent and well-documented opposition in Parliament. And, it, of course, its dubious moral purpose squandered any sympathy that the king might have had for taking the cross in 1250. And it certainly raised questions about Henry's powers of kingly judgment and the quality of the advice that he was receiving from courtiers. Furthermore, the anger generated over £40,000 exacted by papal agents for Sicily from the English church by 1258 added a powerful and vocal element, the church, onto wider calls for reform. No wonder the chroniclers were so biased against Henry III. But Sicily raised even wider complaints. As David Carpenter's Fine Roll project has revealed, in order to raise gold for the crusade, Henry began pressurising gentry, even if they possessed only £15 per annum in land, to take up knighthood or to pay a fine in gold. About 400 paid. This turned Sicily into a complaint registered across the country. Now, another ingredient in 1258 were a series of recent short-term crises. A rebellion broke out in Scotland and Wales, and in 1258, both sides joined together against the English. And as if this was not bad enough, 1258 saw a national disaster, a famine lasting until 1261, causing widespread hunger and death. London in 1258 was engulfed with starving refugees. Now Henry's regime was beginning to collapse. Short of funds to deal even with the Welsh and Scots, let alone Sicily, he was driven into the arms of his parliamentary critics. In 1258, at the April Parliament meeting at Westminster, he demanded a huge tax of novel intensity, and even a tax even heavier than that had been raised to ransom Richard the Lionheart, one third on movables and also immovables. There was uproar. But in 1258, the leadership of the opposition, which propelled Henry under the provisions of Oxford, came not from the English baronage at large, but from a conspiracy between some courtiers, including Henry's own family and a handful of the greatest English earls. Now, this is revealed by my document B, starting at the bottom of page 12, entitled The Swarm Conspiracy of the 12th of April, 1258. And amongst the conspirators, and I've produced a little translation, yes, it's all there in English for you there, you'll see the name of Henry's relation, Peter of Savoy, and another courtier, the Earl of Gloucester, amongst the conspirators. These courtiers were all making a common stance for justice against another group of courtiers, Henry's half-brothers of the House of Lusignan. And at the Oxford Parliament 2 months later, the Lusignans, William de Valence, Aymer, Bishop-elect of Winchester, their brothers Guy and Geoffrey de Lusignan, and a handful of their knightly supporters, were exiled from the realm. This downfall of the Lusignans was opposed by Henry's heir, the Lord Edward, and his cousin Henry of Almaine, and Lewis's own John de Warenne. They all fled from Oxford and tried to make a wild stand at Aymer's castle at Winchester, but they were forced within days to surrender by the vastly greater force of the pursuing reformers. So what had happened behind the scenes? You now have the whiff of soap opera. A split had opened up in Henry's own all-powerful court and happy family. Why had that happened? In the 1230s, the Queen's family, the Savoyards, had held great sway over the king. They were the top dogs at court, and they got on very well with existing courtiers. And they also managed to roll into their bandwagon or outdo any other rivals. Richard of Cornwall, Henry's powerful brother, was won over, not least because of marrying the Queen's glamorous sister, Sancha. They also rolled Simon de Montfort into their bandwagon as well, again, at a price. But they were less successful when in 1247, Henry, poor man, sick of all the earache from his wife's relations, decided to call over his own family from Poitou, the Lusignans. These proved impossible to absorb in the court system. By the 1250s, Henry's finances had begun to deteriorate, as we've suggested, and this created acute pressure on his supply of patronage, lands, and so on, that he could give. He was providing for the Lusignans at exactly the same time as he was establishing the Lord Edward, and also providing further for Simon de Montfort. So not surprisingly, a competitive atmosphere began to gather around the king for grants of land and influence. Even in 1252, the Lusignans clashed with the Savoyards, a particularly nasty incident which you can read about in document A on page 12. I provided a little translation for you there at the top. This is all about Aymer, the Bishop-elect of Winchester, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Boniface of Savoy, where Aymer raided the Archbishop's palaces, and six English earls, including John de Warenne, our Lord from Lewes, took up arms to support, or threatened to take up arms, rather, I should say, to support one side or the other. Nevertheless, the Lusignans' influence at court continued to grow, and they gained a further edge just before 1258, when Henry's heir, the Lord Edward, who was aged 19 and hitherto had been under the protection of the Queen and the Savoyards, began to flex his political muscles and side with his Lusignan cousins. Now, by that stage, the Lusignans, who were young, vigorous hotheads, had drifted into disputes with other courtiers and magnates, including Simon de Montfort and the Earl of Gloucester. So we can see factional instability emerging at the heart of Henry's government. Henry tried to hold the balance between the parties, but he was never very good at that sort of thing. By 1258, it appeared that he began to side disastrously with the Lusignans. Hence, the Lusignan, the courtiers of Peter of Savoy, Archbishop of Canterbury, the Earl of Gloucester, and a variety of other courtiers siding with the rebels in 1258, throwing their lot in with the reformers, plotting the coup, exiling the Lusignans, and ushering in the Provisions of Oxford. At the start of my talk, I suggested that the revolution of 1258 was not all that it seemed. It was never a revolution of the mass of the English baronage against Henry III, never as simple as that. Henry was brought down partly by members of his own family. They were gambling greatly by throwing their lot in with the reformers, and over the next few years, a good deal of the politics of this period would be seen the working out of their relations between these courtiers with the reformers. But that's another story. 1258 was a revolution which was not all that it seemed. It won't be the first revolution or the last revolution to be like that. Thank you very much.